I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy. Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about trauma. So I have a special guest with me today, and I'll allow her to introduce herself.
Thank you. So my name's Jo Stubley. I'm a medical psychiatrist, and I'm also a psychoanalyst, and I lead an adult trauma service.
Amazing. So, Jo, when we're talking about, you know, trauma, I'm thinking about my sort of own experiences or what I perceive, you know, trauma to be. And, you know, on the media or, you know, in books, etc., we understand trauma to be this sort of major event that is experienced at war, or it's a horrific event that, you know, impacts an individual who may have, you know, experienced something traumatic. From your experience, you know, what is trauma? What is the definition of trauma for those who don't know, or for those who have an idea but maybe not a clear concept of what trauma may be?
It sort of feels to me like this is one of the hardest questions in some ways. And I think you've already highlighted a little bit of why that is. Mm. We all probably have a slightly different idea of what trauma is, depending on our own experiences. And in the past, as you say, people often used to think about war or those really big sort of awful public things that would happen, terrorist attacks and those kinds of things. Mm. And it's only in more recent years that we've started to recognise that there's also the more personal and everyday but just as awful kinds of traumas that can happen to children and adults. And I guess in terms of what do we mean by trauma, I think that one of the big definitions that I really like is from a woman called Judith Herman, who is an American trauma expert. And she talks about trauma as being made of two components. The first is disempowerment. So it's an experience of being helpless and overwhelmed, and our usual defences and ways of managing get knocked out. Mm. Then the second thing she brings up is that it's about disconnection from others, that in the moment of the trauma we end up feeling alone, and that often afterwards it makes it much harder for us to connect with other people. So I wonder whether that's a good place for us to start, but I suspect we might talk a little bit more about what this thing is.
No, that's amazing. So this idea of disempowerment and disconnection. And is that something you feel that is felt with the person who's experiencing the trauma only in the moment that they are experiencing it? Or is it something that sort of sticks with them throughout, the sense of disempowerment and disconnection?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think that in general, it continues afterwards. And one of the things that we might understand about trauma is that terrible things can happen to us, and we might have those experiences of disempowerment and disconnection for some time afterwards, and then we find a way to move forwards. Mm. But for some people, those experiences persist. They kind of get a bit stuck in something.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a medical perspective, that's often what we end up talking about when we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Something gets stuck.
Yeah. And when I was doing, you know, some research around trauma, not only for this podcast, but, you know, for my general work as well, I saw a lot of narrative around this idea of little T and big T, so little trauma and big trauma. And, you know, I didn't know that there were any sort of differences. I thought trauma was just trauma. Mm. Could you sort of shed a light on what little T and big T is in terms of trauma?
Yeah, I think it's a really useful way of thinking about the different types. And it was sort of what I was touching on earlier, that some people can have those great big traumas that any of us would say, well, that's a, you know, terrible traumatic thing that's happened, being involved in some big disaster, you know, a large fire or something that's clear that everyone says this is traumatic. That's the big T kinds of traumas.
Yeah.
Often the small T's on their own might not even look like trauma. So if you're thinking about a child, it might be that there's bullying that happens every day, or that there is situations at home, often linked to this idea around the research on adverse childhood experiences that we might talk about more, the sort of the things that happen to many of us as we're growing up, whether it's different types of abuse or parents separating or domestic violence, that the incidents on their own might not look like this is a major traumatic event, but they can be really cumulative. So the more that these things happen, the more someone becomes traumatized, maybe even without quite knowing it themselves.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, when you mentioned bullying, I sort of put my thinking hat on and I was positioning myself, you know, as when I was head of year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, many students had experienced, you know, bullying in the school, but I would have never thought that could be a trauma for them. But then, you know, I'm sort of recollecting and going back to this idea of disempowerment and disconnection, and actually when that builds up, when the bullying, you know, is continuing, that they will see that as trauma. And you often get, you know, many adults, you know, when you ask them about their childhood experiences, or how was secondary school for you? No, I don't want to talk about it. How was primary school for you? That wasn't a good time for me. I can definitely understand that.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think one of the things that in the psychiatric textbooks, when they try and define trauma, they concentrate on the big T's. But they're starting to do more research around things like bullying in children, and also things like stalking for adults. And what they're finding is exactly what you just described, that actually it is something that's so awful that people often don't want to talk about it. There's something that's been really traumatizing because it's been happening over time, and it's become something that is a kind of chronic or complex trauma.
Yeah. What are some misconceptions about trauma in adults from your experience?
I think we've just touched on a couple of them. I think that there can still be a bit of an idea that trauma, and in particular things like PTSD, it's only really war veterans or people who've been in terrorist attacks and things like that. There's an idea that somehow ordinary everyday events are not going to cause problems. I think that's a real misconception. And I think that isolates people further, because then they feel like, well, what's wrong with me that I feel so awful? I also think that there's a misconception around an idea that it's about being weak, or that there's something wrong, that I've had this big response to something that's happened. And, you know, people will look around and think, well, someone else went through these things and they're not having the struggles I did. And for me, that's partly connected to a recognition that trauma is a really personal experience. So we can all go through adversity, but for some people, that particular adversity, because of, you know, that the nature of it, the timing of it, who they are and what their life history has been, that will all contribute to whether or not it's traumatic for that person, and whether or not they'll struggle to be able to move forward afterwards. So I often think about it in terms of, you know, there's a statistic that says about 50% of us in the population will at some point have something that's potentially a significant traumatic event. But only about 6 to 7% of people go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. So there is a lot of resilience and a lot of capacity out there, but those 6 or 7% of people, it's their particular experience in their life. And that's often very linked to the risk factors that we know about for trauma.
Wow. And, you know, when we consider, you know, teachers and educators, I think one of the key things for teachers and educators is that their role is to essentially impart, you know, knowledge and, you know, wisdom to their students, etc. But there's also a pastoral responsibility to be there for, you know, your students, to care for your students, to connect with your students. Do you think that teachers who have experienced, you know, trauma may have difficulties or may be impacted in their ability to teach and connect with their students as a result of their trauma?
It's a great question. And I think that it's one of those questions that I'm going to say it depends.
Mm.
And it depends on whether or not the teacher has had the opportunity, in whatever way works for them, to work through their own trauma.
Mm.
So to have some understanding of their own life history, of what's happened to them, what the impact has been, and that they're not stuck in it.
Mm.
And if that's the case, then I think that would make them particularly good at pastoral care for possibly traumatized kids.
Mm.
Because what they would understand is they'd be able to pick up some of the signs that you might see that says this person's struggling.
Mm.
If someone hasn't worked through their own trauma and they've still got a lot of difficulties and they're trying to teach traumatized children, they might get triggered themselves. They might end up feeling a lot of the symptoms. We might want to talk a little bit more about that, of being caught in their own trauma, and that gets sort of mixed in with the children's trauma.
So would you say then that teachers who have experienced trauma are essentially in a better position to support, you know, students who are going, you know, through trauma as well? Because you mentioned, you know, teachers being able to pick up cues. So would you, you know, do you feel that they're in a better position to sort of support students who have gone through trauma themselves?
I guess my short answer is if they get it. If they know that they've been traumatized, if they can pick up that there are difficulties that they might struggle with, if they know, you know, that if a child behaves in this certain way, it might activate certain things in me, so I need to be careful, you know. If they are able to do that, then, yeah, I think they make great teachers because they are able to understand through their own experience what's happened. But I also think there's something about there has to be a space even for those teachers who get it to be able to talk about what they're seeing, because they're probably going to end up having a lot of emotional responses stirred up in themselves by working with traumatized children. Mm. And that's one thing that we see as a part of our work. We see traumatized adults within a psychotherapy service. And it inevitably stirs up a lot of feelings in us as therapists, and we have to have a space to talk about those.
Yeah. No, that's very helpful. And when I consider perhaps, you know, if a teacher has had childhood experience of, you know, domestic violence or self-harmed as a child, or experience, you know, racism, you know, all of these different traumas as a child, in their teaching capacity, if they see these, you know, experiences, these traumatic experiences that they went through as a child manifest in the students that they are teaching, like how does that impact them, and what sort of things do we see in teachers when they're dealing with those, you know, sort of triggers essentially?
I wonder whether the best way for us to think about this is to start by talking about what impact trauma has. So what we might be seeing in the children and what the teachers might be struggling with. So when someone has a traumatic experience and they end up getting, I keep saying stuck in it because I think that's a good description.
Yeah.
They end up with what might look like post-traumatic stress disorder, or it might even be that, or some of these symptoms. And there's three main categories of that. One is what they call hyperarousal. Now, what that essentially means is that fight-flight response that everyone kind of gets in relation to when you're under threat. So these will often be, for the kids, the sorts of kids that are getting set off all the time. They can't sit still very easily. They can't concentrate. They might be responding in more of a fight kind of way. You know, they will get really stirred up by things and might get very angry very quickly.
Yeah.
That's the sort of fight-flight bit of the hyperarousal. The second bit is that people get what we call the reliving experiences of trauma. And these are ways in which trauma memories get laid down differently. So usually when we have an experience, we put it into our story of our lives and we can access that memory when we want to and then we can put it away.
Yeah.
Trauma memories get laid down differently. And if they don't get processed, they stay in this same kind of way where they can get triggered by certain things that are connected to the original trauma. Might be a word, might be a colour, might be a sound, often a smell, maybe a particular feeling or setting.
Yeah.
And when that's triggered, they can feel like they're back in the trauma. This is what we mean by a flashback. It's like it's happening again now.
Wow.
And when that happens, they don't really have much control over it. And they might just sort of look like they're no longer really paying attention, or they might be looking really distressed. Sometimes they have all of the bodily experiences of what happened in the original trauma. They might get horrible images in their minds. So when you got those first two of the hyperarousal and the reliving, the third one makes sense that people avoid. They will avoid by often, these might be the kids who just don't turn up. Yeah. That's also linked to the fight, to the flight bit of the fight-flight response. But they also often avoid by shutting down. They're just not there. They're emotionally quite numb. And that might come out just in terms of not really feeling like you can make contact with them. They're not really properly present. They don't look like they're making much contact with the other children in the class. So if teachers are picking up on those sorts of things, then they're probably going to be able to think there's something that's going on with this.
Yeah.
But if they've got their own traumas, they might be getting triggered and activated themselves unless they know already what activates and triggers them and can do the work to help calm themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a rather long-winded answer, but I hope that helps.
That's very interesting. And when you speak about trauma memory, because I've had this discussion with people time and time again, and as far as I'm concerned, I find it sort of hard to believe that, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself, that I can have a traumatic experience that I've suppressed to the point that I don't remember it. Because I've had good and bad experiences in my life, and you know, from when I can remember my first memory, I can recall all my negative and positive, experiences. So this idea that actually you can have a traumatic memory that you've suppressed, avoided, or shut behind a door that you just won't remember again, I find that sort of difficult. To comprehend for myself, but for many, that is a reality.
Absolutely. And I think you've described it really well, because I think there are different ways that we can not remember.
Mm.
Some of it might be more a conscious avoiding. That's just, I don't want to go there. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. A bit like that example you gave earlier about the bullying.
Yeah.
I liked your description of sometimes things get put behind a closed door, because I think that links with the potential for someone to dissociate. And if you think about it, have you ever had a journey where you're sort of preoccupied with something and you get home and think, I don't remember any of that journey, because you've been so caught up in your thoughts that you haven't really noticed that you've been getting on doing these things? That's a mild form of dissociation. But when people have experienced a traumatic event and they've gone into the freeze state, so that's after the fight flight, and then their body is switching off all of that getting ready for action that fight flight is about, and instead is starting to go into freeze, which is a way that the body shuts down to protect from a lot of danger and potential damage. There is a way that the mind finds that so unbearable that it does this thing called dissociation, which is like the escape when there's no escape. So some of our patients talk about, well, this awful thing was happening, and then it just felt like I wasn't really there anymore. I wasn't in my body. I was watching it from the ceiling, or I was watching it from afar. And at its most extreme, they sort of tell the story and then say, but from this bit, I don't remember anything else. And that's the defense of, as you said, sort of closing that door and saying, I'm just not going to be here for the rest of that. And that whole memory then gets put away in a room, and it can stay there a long time. Some of us, it might stay behind a door forever. The trouble is, more traumas will often blow those doors open.
Wow. So can teachers, educators, or adults be in a workplace where they've essentially suppressed these traumas, but then there are triggers around them that are causing them to react in certain way, but they don't know why, and it's linked to that trauma?
Yeah, I mean, the example that I'm thinking of as you're saying that is, imagine someone who has grown up with a lot of violence, a lot of verbal abuse, hasn't sort of really ever had an opportunity to talk about that with anyone else, has kind of put it behind those doors, tried really hard not to engage it, becomes a teacher, is doing really well, but maybe then gets one particular child who might themselves be traumatized, who responds in that angry fight kind of way. What would it be like for that teacher to have this child right up in their face shouting at them? How much of a trigger would that be for maybe some of those memories of the earlier experiences starting to come back in a way that might feel a bit overwhelming and flooding and really difficult for that teacher?
Yeah, no, thank you very much. That was very insightful. And how can, when we consider the environments that, you know, teachers work in, how can teachers manage these triggers? What sort of coping mechanisms can they put in place? And I think it's really important to consider the environment that they're working in a sense, you know, some may see schools as hostile in a sense that it's fast paced, you know, teachers are up and down, you know, there's deadlines, there's SLT, you know, when's Ofsted coming in, shouting on the playground and whatever else.
Yeah.
And a teacher might be going for a traumatic or stressful experience and they just need to do something to cope. What sort of things can they put in place considering their environment that they're in?
Yeah. I really like the way you've described that, because I think it is really important to look at the environment first of all. One of the things that happened after the pandemic, I think that we got into a whole kind of really positive overall idea about, you know, we should all be responsible for our own self-care and we ought to be thinking about how we look after ourselves, which is right, and we can think more about that. But it's not just our responsibility. It is also the organisations that we work in.
Yeah.
And I think what you've just described really well is actually that's a really difficult environment to work in. You got all of that kind of physical stress of the noise and the kind of pressure and the constant things happening, and all the psychological stress of the deadlines and the worries. And that, I think, is something that really has to get acknowledged within organisations.
Yeah.
I'm one of the things that, you know, I know we've talked about before and that I think is a really good move in this is the growing movement of trauma-informed care. And I think that they focus very much on what we can do individually, but also how organisations might have to shift and change in a way that allows for some recognition and some responses to that high-pressure environment.
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, onus and responsibility needs to go to, you know, the organisation leads, the senior leadership team, the head teachers, in terms of what provisions are they putting in place to ensure that, you know, their teachers and their staff have that space for self-care, essentially. If we consider, you know, teachers, you know, support staff and educators within the classroom, what advice would you give to teachers who are maybe, you know, struggling to, you know, manage the classroom due to maybe experiences of, you know, trauma or related stress? And if we think, for example, you know, the example that you gave previously of a teacher who may have experienced, you know, a lot of verbal abuse growing up, and now they're in a classroom of students who are just sort of hurling, you know, verbal abuse. What advice can you give them in terms of managing the classroom, considering the trauma that they've been through?
I guess in some ways I think you're probably much better at the advice on managing the classroom, but I can talk about managing themselves, because I think there's something, first of all, in that example about having to listen in to yourself, first of all. You know, for that teacher, what's going on in their body when this is happening? They probably start to notice that they're getting really tense and anxious and maybe wanting to hit out. Once you start noticing the things that are going on, then I would say the next really big piece of advice I would give is talk to someone.
Well,
don't try and just keep going with it, but find someone, whether it's a trusted colleague or someone more senior in the school or a good friend, someone who you feel is safe enough that you can trust them to say, this is really hard. Something's going on. I need to be able to think about this. And I think that's part of what I meant when I was saying about organisations need to think about how we create more spaces to make that possible. So, you know, in my organisation, I think there's something about we often struggle with having enough of those informal spaces, you know, when you're all making a cup of tea together and you might just say, for us, we often say, well, that was just a really difficult session. And a teacher might be saying, I just had a really difficult class then.
Yeah.
And those sorts of connections, I think, are the first step really in self-care.
Yeah.
And, you know, it can become more formal of having things like reflective practice groups where people actually are encouraged with support from an external person to be able to talk about these sorts of things. But there's also something really simple that I think that we can all sort of do and notice, which is if you're talking about the fight, flight, freeze response, when you start to notice that you're getting really anxious or that your muscles are tensing or that you're finding something really difficult, we've got this amazing thing built in where we can switch off that part of our nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, just by slowing our breathing down.
Wow.
So that whole thing that people say of, you know, just take a breath, is actually right. If you take a slow, deep breath and actually let the outward breath go even longer than the inward, so you might in for four, pause for two, out for a count of six, that switches off some of the fight flight.
Okay.
So the first thing for that teacher might be when the child's right in his face, take a big breath and just see whether that can help slow something down inside you and help you to be able to think a little bit more.
No, that's amazing. And I really want to touch, you know, on this point when you mentioned about, you know, just simply talking to others. Mm. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, we've got this platform, because I think, you know, there is definitely power in storytelling. And I recall after, you know, the first episode, that, you know, I did, and I had guests talking about their experience of leaving teaching. I had a colleague of mine who's an educator at another school, and she's been there, you know, 10 years, and she reflected on one of the points that the guests made about mental health. And she said, and my colleague said to me, I thought it was just me. I thought it was just me that was, you know, going through that, because no one is having these conversations. And she's been in her role 10 years. And I thought to myself, 10 years. And you've never thought, you know, to ask another teacher or another member of staff, are you going through what I'm going through, or this is what I'm going through, you know, in this moment. So there is definitely power in, you know, just speaking to someone.
Absolutely. And I think I really like the fact that you call it power, because it does do that thing with the disempowerment, doesn't
it? Yeah.
And it also is saying, if you are on your own after things are really difficult, then you are going to feel more disempowered. If you reach out, you are taking back your power and you're talking to people. And I think you've also touched on something else. I think that one of the problems that often happens is that people feel ashamed. They have this kind of, this must say something about me, that there's something wrong with me. Everyone else looks like they're coping. Mm. And that's one of the things that I think we have to really challenge. And I think these kinds of podcasts are absolutely the way to do that, to get it out there and be having the conversations of, we're all struggling. This is not an easy world to be living in right now. And I think that perspective is important too, because we talked about the individual, the classroom and the school and the kind of organisation of the school, but we've got to think, this country's struggling. You know, the world is in a pretty bad state with a lot of trauma going on right now, and that's impacting on all of us.
Yeah. Can teaching be a trauma? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, the explanation you gave earlier about the little traumas, the little T's, and all of these possible associated traumas that come with teaching, the environment, the low pay, the deadlines, the workload. Can teaching be considered a trauma?
I have no doubt, and I want to add in a couple of other things to kind of expand on that, because again, I think this was work that came out of the pandemic when they were looking at people who were working on the front line, and I think teaching is very much on the front line.
Yeah.
There are two concepts that I find really useful that are linked to people being more at risk of being traumatized. One is the idea of moral injury. They first described this when they were talking about soldiers who either had to engage with or witnessed things that went against their ethical or moral code. And I think in really underfunded systems and systems that are struggling, a lot of frontline professionals end up feeling morally injured, that this is not how I want to do things. This doesn't feel ethically right. And this is an ordinary human response, but it puts people more at risk of being traumatized. So that's one bit. And the other big bit that they found in research during the pandemic for frontline health staff is what they called institutional betrayal, of feeling that in trying to do your job as well as you can, that you get let down by the people who are in charge at whatever level you're talking about. But those experiences, either of moral injury or institutional betrayal, can leave people feeling really vulnerable, and I think at times leaves them feeling traumatized in a way that, you know, if something happened in the classroom and those things weren't present, they'd probably be able to manage it.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That was very insightful, institutional betrayal. I'm going to go research that as soon as we leave here. When we think about, you know, the narratives around, you know, trauma, how it's expressed and how it's treated within, you know, different communities and different societies, in what way does sort of cultural background influence, you know, people's perceptions and experiences of trauma?
I think it's really important that we recognise that people's different cultural experiences, genders, sexuality, all the different kind of areas that we might say are a part of intersectionality can have a profound experience on how different people will experience and then respond to trauma. And from our perspective in the work that we do, we're often trying to think about that in relation to how it might be impacting in terms of the disempowerment. You know, so for instance, a fairly obvious thing to say is that if you've experienced a lot of racism in your life, it might make having traumatic experiences even more difficult because you've already had that sense of disempowerment. So I think it might make you respond to things in different ways, and those things need to be thought about on an individual basis. But I also think there can be things culturally, like there are a number of different cultures that would see talking outside the immediate family about anything that's happened to you or your responses to it, your feelings about it, might be seen even to the extreme of being a betrayal of the family.
Yeah.
And that has a big impact then, you know. What do you do if the trauma feels like it's within the family, but to go outside of it would be almost like turning your back on the family?
Yeah.
And so those sorts of things I think need to be thought about very carefully, and we need to find ways that address those cultural issues.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. And, you know, earlier you mentioned this, you know, this idea of trauma-informed care. And I know that last year, the government and the YEF, so the Youth Endowment Fund, you know, plumped a lot of money into trauma-informed research. So for those who don't, you know, understand what is trauma-informed practice, that's being rolled out, I think, amongst, you know, many schools, and how does that benefit schools having a trauma-informed approach?
I really think that there's something about this approach that is just doing what we're already talking about, trying to get people thinking about and recognising that there are a lot of traumatised people out there, and to see what might allow us to notice that. So there are four R's that trauma-informed care suggests that we need to think about, and they are realise, recognise, respond, and resist re-traumatisation. Now, the realise bit is part of what I think you're doing, which is getting people to see that there is a lot of trauma out there.
Mm.
We know that from the adverse childhood experiences research, where they took 10 common adverse childhood experiences, so childhood physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, domestic violence, parents who had substance misuse problems, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And most of us have had at least one, but the more you have, the more likely you are to have difficulties. So knowing that trauma is common and it's out there, knowing the kinds of things that you need to recognise, so there's the second R, and we've been talking about that in terms of the ways in which people might present with trauma.
Mm.
The third R is responding appropriately. And again, that's been part of the conversation we've been having. How do we, if someone is, you know, looking like they're in a hyper-aroused state, it's not great to make them feel even worse by telling them off or telling them they've got to sit down, or but trying and find a way to respond that helps to contain them and helps them feel calmer, which might be as simple as talking in a ordinary and sort of gentle and calming way.
Yeah.
And then the fourth R is that we want to make sure that we don't make things worse.
Yeah.
And starting with that feels really important. And then trauma-informed care sort of spans out to just make us really think about how do we work alongside people. And I think for me that's kind of coming back to the power thing again, that if you are recognizing that someone's been disempowered. You don't want to be coming at them from a hierarchical perspective.
Yeah.
You want to get alongside them and say, you know, how can we do this together? So collaboration and mutual work and helping people to feel that you are responding to them from the appropriate kind of place in terms of their cultural and religious backgrounds, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So it's not rocket science, is it? Once you start to kind of think about this stuff, it all sort of just makes sense. But I think what it also does is it's saying, in order to work with traumatized people, we need to know all of this, and then we need to look after ourselves. So that comes back to the bit we were talking about before about self-care.
Yeah.
That if you're going to do this kind of work with people who may well be traumatized, it's going to have an impact on you. And if you don't look out, it's going to potentially get into your body so that you end up feeling burnt out, traumatized yourself, what they call vicarious traumatization.
Mm.
And that's the kind of thing that will make people leave. The good yeah. teachers may well leave because it's all kind of, it's not been talked about. It's all just being held in the body.
Yeah. And how can school create a supportive, you know, environments for their teachers, their educators, their support staff to be able to, you know, welcome and have that self-care?
I think that's in some ways quite a hard question because if I think about what you were describing to me about the environment, and that sounds very similar to our environment in the NHS at the moment, probably both organisations really underfunded
yeah.
and then frontline people are really under pressure.
Mm.
But somehow, and I think the trauma-informed care is a bit like a kind of, it legitimizes the things that otherwise might feel a bit like, well, you can't do that. You haven't got time. You've got to get on with your teaching. It says, actually, it's vital that we take time out. It's really vital that we look after each other,
yeah.
that we create spaces to talk to each other about the work and what's going on so that we can help the traumatized, you know, students or patients for us. And actually, it is a way in which we protect staff from leaving, from becoming unwell themselves in this really high-pressured environment.
Yeah, that's amazing. And the final question before we finish off, if there's any way that you would want to change how trauma is seen in society, what would that look like?
It's a great question. And I suppose what I would want to say is to see trauma as something more ordinary that we could all end up having to deal with.
Yeah.
And that maybe if we can all get a lot better at noticing what we're feeling and then connecting with each other and talking about what we're feeling, we might all manage trauma as a society much more.
Yeah. That's amazing. Thank you very much. Thank you again for joining the podcast. And, you know, this episode for me was very insightful, and I'm sure our viewers will feel the same. So thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate that. This has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you like the content, please subscribe to all of our social media pages, and we'll see you next time for a new episode.